I don't know how my colleagues feel. Are y'all ready to proceed to the third case? Okay, then I'll call the case of James Larwith versus Magellan Health.
I'm not sure I'm on the video. That's been shown.
You're not on my video.
Okay. May I suggest we take a break?
Yes. Yes.
See if we can.
So my watch says 10:12 and what, a 3 minute break, or you want longer?
I was just to give some opportunity to figure this video out.
Okay. We'll take a 5 minute break then.
Thank you. I can't start the video because it says the host has stopped it. Okay. Now it's on.
I'm going to go ahead and stop everybody's video while we're breaking, and then we'll restart. Hey, Judge.
Hello. Okay. It said you would disable me, Tom. I thought maybe I was misbehaving.
No, we just went ahead and stopped the video during the break just so nobody can see anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you get up with the virtual background, it does show a little bit.
Yeah.
I was going to check with Judge Brasher when he arrives, if he wants to look at his video audio before we start.
Yeah, I am. I'm here, but I've blocked out a video.
Oh, sorry.
There we go.
Okay.
Yeah, is my audio working?
It's not great.
It's a little low. Do you see your microphone in the bottom left corner?
Yes.
If you go to audio settings, you can change your volume on the imp microphone piece.
I have it the whole way up to the.
And what does it say under to the right of test mic to the microphone, right of it?
USB 2.0 camera. Is it worse today than it was yesterday?
It's different, I think. Yeah. Can you tell, Robert?
Yeah.
Yes, it's lower.
Yeah, a little bit lower. Maybe, perhaps, is it acceptable for us to continue and then after that we can try to troubleshoot?
Yeah, I can hear you now, Andrew, but at one point during the last argument, you dropped off almost completely.
Okay.
I can talk really loud. I can yell. I feel bad yelling at an advocate.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll bring everybody in. We'll be ready to start and we'll work with you, Judge, after. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We can see you now. I'm not sure your colleague is here. Is Ms. Cox on?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. Great. All right. Well, then I'll try again. I'll call the case. And good morning, Mr. Singer.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, I'm Stuart Singer on behalf of the appellant James Larwood. There are several independent issues that warrant reversal of the preliminary injunction as a matter of law. I'd like in my argument to focus on two. One will be the decision as a matter of law to disregard the issue of prior breach of terms of the employment agreement that relate to a bonus and commissions that would be received in a separate document. We think the court was erred in saying that those are not incorporated as a matter of law, and so the issue of prior breach did not have to be considered beyond that. And second, the court did not enforce Federal Rule Civil Procedure 65's requirement of evidence of irreparable injury, instead preferring to use a Connecticut law presumption when in federal court it's Rule 65 that should govern. And despite the fact that even by the terms of the Connecticut law, that presumption doesn't apply when there's been a delay between the violation of the covenant and when the motion for preliminary injunction is brought. Before turning to those two arguments, however, I'd like to say a few words about the status of the case in the district court, because the case is set for a jury trial on January 5, 2021. Of course, due to COVID, no one can be certain that it will actually proceed at that time. There are issues in the case on the claim by Magellan for damages from breach. The court has granted a summary judgment on enforceability of the non-compete agreement and the non-solicitation of customers, but not the employee non-solicitation provision. There are also claims by Larwith for damages that will be tried. So although that trial is coming up, this appeal from a preliminary injunction still matters very much. First of all, the preliminary injunction remains in effect and it's preventing Mr. Larwith from competing in the manner that he would like to do. And second, Magellan is claiming at the trial that they're entitled to a permanent injunction to tack on to the covenant, which would expire by its terms in January 21, a longer period of time. And if the preliminary injunction was wrongful ab initio, it clearly would be improper to extend it further. And I note that even the terms of the order entered by the district court does not, as it should, terminate in the time in January 2021, when the three-year period from the termination of Mr. Larwith occurred back in 2018. So I'd like to turn to the first argument of prior breach. There's no question that a prior breach of an employment agreement is a complete and full defense under Connecticut law to a case like this. There's also no question that the district court did not reach that defense on the merits because of a legal determination that the bonus, commission, incentive plans would be in a separate document that was not yet in existence at the time the employment agreement was signed. And that's error because a future agreement can be incorporated into an employment agreement here, and it was expressly referenced in the employment agreement that Mr. Larwith will be eligible for these benefits. This does not contradict any of the terms of the employment agreement that was in existence. Rather, it particularized those obligations. And that is what Connecticut courts have said is entirely proper. We cite in our brief cases from Connecticut, such as the McKenzie case, where the court says if the provisions will only explain or particularize the obligations of the parties, there's no obligation to the enforcement of those supplemental provisions. The Mosby case found a description of benefits was properly incorporated. And the Lamb case, which we cite, which is a federal case applying Connecticut law, dealt with future plan amendments to options that were not yet into effect. Now think about the effect of an alternative ruling. That would allow parties to avoid obligations to their employees by separating the non-compete into a separate agreement and saying, well, we're not concerned about the obligations of the employer to the employee. Those could be breached with impunity and the employee wouldn't have a defense. And I think the unfairness of that is evident.
What do you say about the standard that the Connecticut courts have that require that to future agreement into a present agreement, that there has to be, quote, an ascertainable standard, end quote, for the new agreement, the future agreement?
Well, I think that has to be read in the context that it has to particularize the obligations, describe those obligations, and then it's ascertainable, and it can't contradict what's already in the agreement. If it contradicts, then it's hard to ascertain because what would govern? But if it only explains and particularizes, then I think what you have is a meeting of the minds that whatever that bonus plan will be in this case, whatever that commission plan will be, it's incorporated into the agreement and the employer has to live by it. And a breach of that is a claim of prior breach of the employment agreement itself. I would turn to the second argument now, which is that there is also independent error by accepting here a presumption of irreparable injury. And I think the record is clear that the court did apply Connecticut's presumption of irreparable injury. It said that expressly, and it also said that Larwith wasn't able to overcome that presumption. And although opposing counsel has argued that they are findings of irreparable injury, we do not see that in the court's opinion. Findings of irreparable injury in this context would be findings that the plaintiff was, or in this case, the counterplaintiff was harmed by certain acts, and it would not be possible to determine that with certainty, and so you have irreparable injury, or that there would be a lack of goodwill that cannot be determined with sufficient certainty. You don't have those kind of findings here. What you have are findings of breach.
Well, what about the district court's, I think it's on page 13 of the injunction, where the district court says that, it's through 13 through 14, talking about your argument, such an argument ignores the fact that Larwith is unfairly competing with Magellan It does not appear that the market is as fluid as Larwith would like the court to believe. Magellan has established sufficient irreparable harm to support the issuance of a preliminary injunction. Isn't that a finding of irreparable harm sufficient?
I think respectfully, it is a confusion of breach of the agreement with a finding of irreparable injury. I don't see how the fluidity of a market establishes whether or not the claimant would be able to establish in damages that the loss of customers would be compensable in damages. And I note here that there's going to be a trial in the district court on exactly that, the claim that there was a loss of customers, which Magellan is seeking to quantify the economic effects from. What I see is that is in the context of a court which clearly believed that the presumption was applicable because it says that they are, citing Connecticut law, rebuttably presumed when a covenant not to compete has been found to impose a restraint. And that comes right in the sentence following the one that Your Honor quoted. So I think the court may also be simply saying that it is established that because of the presumption, which has not been rebutted, which of course begs the question whether the presumption should apply at all. The presumption should not apply here for two reasons. One, because it is going from the Supreme Court cases of eBay and other cases like Commodore, it is clear that you have to prove irreparable injury under Rule 65. You cannot presume it. To the extent some cases have allowed for an exception when a statute creates a presumption, there is no statutory presumption here under Connecticut law. Secondly, even if one accepted the presumption under Connecticut law, it would not operate here because the Connecticut cases make clear that they are applying that presumption because in a situation where someone runs into court immediately after it has been a violation, there isn't the availability then of evidence that there's been damages, that there's evidence that can be used to prove that harm. And in those circumstances, and only those circumstances, is the presumption applicable. And that is set forth in our briefs. And there's a case that's directly on point with respect to that. And that is the Opticare case, that the presumption applies when the plaintiff moves immediately and there's no opportunity to show the effects of the violation. And I would note, Your Honors, in connection with that, that all the debate in the briefs about whether the court found there was an excuse for the delay in bringing a claim, whether it was settlement conversations or something like that, is beside the point. Those may be relevant to a latches defense, but they're not relevant to an issue of whether the presumption applies. The presumption only applies when there isn't delay, because the courts say that. And the logic of it is, if you have delayed, as you have here, 9 months, for whatever reason, you should be in a position to come forward with evidence to prove your actual irreparable injury. And therefore, for both of those reasons, Rule 65 says you do not rely upon that. And because of the fact Connecticut law doesn't import a presumption in these circumstances, those are reversible errors. Since I have a little time left, I just want to make note that this is an unusual case where people talk about the public interest. And here there is also an issue regarding whether the public interest is disturbed by an injunction which prevents an individual like Mr. Larwith from continuing to provide the economic benefits, which record says flow through to others in the community, of these lower drug prices that he has been negotiating with the plans. Now, I understand that gets into issues of the evidence that were in the district court, but it is an issue that's been fully briefed, and we rely on that as well as the other points in our papers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joyce Ackerbaum Cox, and I represent the appellee Magellan Health. Context is important here, particularly when we are dealing with equitable relief like a preliminary injunction. Here, the court should affirm the district court's order granting the preliminary injunction in favor of Magellan. A little bit of background. This case represents egregious violations of restrictive covenants by Mr. Larwith. As this court is aware, these restrictive covenants are contained in Larwith's employment agreement with Magellan, which he knowingly entered into when the business he was employed by, CDMI, was sold to Magellan and he was then re-employed by Magellan in 2014 as the Senior Vice President of Business Development. And at that time, he received a $12 million bonus upon sale. After separating from Magellan in January of 2018, Larwith set out in a systematic effort to compete directly with Magellan in the very narrow market of pharmacy rebate management, and admittedly actively solicited 20 or more of Magellan's total client base, which is only 30 to 40 clients. So 50 to 75% of the clients he solicited. And he successfully won business from several of them. And as further admitted by Mr. Larwith at the evidentiary hearing, every single piece of business that he obtained in his new company came from Magellan's clients that either Mr. Larwith or his team directly serviced while he was at Magellan. This business that Larwith won, as testified to in May of 2019 at the preliminary injunction hearing, generated $16 million at that time for Mr. Larwith. Importantly, Larwith does not dispute that he is directly competing and violating the restrictive covenants, which is why this case is very different than many non-compete types of cases we see. And after a full evidentiary hearing,
can I ask you about that?
Yes, sir.
It's rare that I've ever seen, and I'm certainly not the most experienced person on this Zoom call right here, but it's rare that I've seen where a lawyer for a client specifically tells somebody, I am going to compete against you. I am going to break whatever covenant that's there. It's not, in my view, not enforceable. And I'm going to take $20 million of your business. That, as I understand, happened in June of the year that Mr. Larwith was terminated. Why does that not put Magellan on notice at that point that it immediately needs to seek to enforce what it views as an enforceable restrictive covenant? And why does the failure to do that not diminish any argument regarding irreparable harm?
Your Honor, the record is clear if you look at, and there's a very fulsome record with respect to the timing of this that the district court considered in very careful detail. In June of 2018, you're right, there was a letter, and we would submit that it was a bold proclamation, but immediately Magellan set out to understand, what are you competing in, what specific area, what will you be doing, are you going after our customers, and endeavored to ask questions. And we got no meaningful response. And
certainly you didn't have all the information, and that's probably true of every seeking of an injunction, but he definitely said, I am competing in this very space that my non-solicitation and non-compete agreement say I can't compete in, right?
He did say that in the letter, but I don't think that he gave any opportunity or any information as evidenced over the next several months to meaningfully understand exactly what he was doing.
Is the law that a party is required to engage in full discovery and have full knowledge before they are at least on notice that someone is violating a provision and need to file a preliminary injunction? Is that our law? Or does our law say that as soon as you know, you need to file something?
I don't think it's either. I think it's kind of a hybrid. The law certainly doesn't say that as soon as you know, you have to file, and the law certainly doesn't say you get full evidence. But there, you know, as these cases go, many times you'll go to the court and you've got, in this case, Rule 11 obligations to say, we are suffering irreparable harm. And in that situation, the court would say, well, what is your evidence of irreparable harm? So this argument tends up to be somewhat circular, right? We would be right back here if we went in at that time and not necessarily able to satisfy our good faith obligations to say, here's the harm that we're suffering. And in fact, you know, as the court analyzed at the lower court level, there were, you know, opportunities for us to try to understand what exactly was going on so that we could determine whether it was proper to go in and get an injunction.
It just seems to read to me that, and the argument you seem to be making and the district court seemed to rely on, is that I needed full discovery of the clients that are there, and until they answered my interrogatory, I could not file. Even though by then in November, you had filed a counterclaim based on the violation there. How can you have Rule 11, how could you have met the Rule 11 good faith obligations to have filed a counterclaim in November of 2018 and then not file the preliminary injunction until March. There seems to be a disconnect there.
Well, we obviously believe we satisfied the Rule 11 obligations when we filed the counterclaim, because at that point, he continued to be evasive and we felt we had no choice, right? We went back and forth for a bit of time to try to understand. And without getting any further, we said, we don't have any choice here but to file based upon these proclamations. But that's why I said the context is important, because as the district court is well aware, Mr. Larwith engaged in vast amounts of hiding the ball and intentional and deliberate delay tactics so as to avoid providing that information.
Well, he may have done that with regard to discovery, and that's not really before us, but you can't say he hid the ball in terms of what his intentions were and what he wanted to do. I mean, again, going back to the June letter and then the October letter, rarely do you see someone admit that clearly that they are in violation of an agreement, right?
Well, I think that that's true, but I think that when you're looking at the delay issue, the district court, considered all of those issues and found that the delay was reasonable, and that's a factual finding that the district court made in light of the entirety of the record below.
And it's not, and just to correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just that he admitted that he was going to violate the agreement. He took the legal position that the agreement was unenforceable. So it required you to do some work to figure out what his position was, whether he was right, etc.
Correct.
Would you mind talking about the contract issue, about the incorporation of the employment agreement? Because I'll just tell you, I think that's the best argument that the other side makes.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. First of all, three important points, and obviously our position is that we think that the judge properly found that the agreement was not incorporated by reference. Factually, there is no language in either the employment agreement or the 2015 commission plan which incorporates by reference the other. Number two, it's undisputed that the 2015 commission plan was not even contemplated or in existence until more than 1 year after the employment agreement was signed. And in fact, at the time the agreement was signed, there was no commission plan in place whatsoever.
But does that matter? Does that matter under Connecticut law?
I think it does matter, because it goes to the knowledge of an assent issue, which I'll get to in one moment, if I could, Your Honor. The CEO testified at the preliminary injunction, and he's the one that drafted it. He testified that the commission plan was a standalone document unrelated to the employment agreement. That evidence was uncontroverted. But I think the most important point is that the language that Mr. Larwith relies on is very general, and it states only that he will be eligible to participate in any annual incentive bonus plan during his employment. It speaks of hypothetical and potential future plans and does not, contrary to Mr. Larwith's position, explicitly reference any specific plan, and certainly doesn't explicitly reference the 2015 plan. And if you look at the housing authority case that's cited in the of a derivative by reference is whether the contracting party knew of and assented to the additional provisions. And the courts will only incorporate by reference when the whole writing and the circumstances surrounding its making evidence is that if there is no knowledge and assent, the only substitution of that is contract, a quote, clear ascertainable standard for promulgating new rules to substitute for the knowledge and assent rule. So here we submit, you can't have knowledge and assent when the plan is not even contemplated at the time, right? You cannot, there's nothing that would give him the ability to agree to the terms. Second, there is a complete absence in the employment agreement of any standard, nonetheless an ascertainable standard for promulgating the new rules. The terms of the commission.
How can you say it's not contemplated? the argument you're about to make, I understand a little bit better, but the agreement section 4B, as I understand it, says, quote, employee also will be eligible to participate in any annual incentive bonus plan and any long-term incentive plan applicable to employee by their terms respectively. I mean, it's certainly contemplated that there will be an annual incentive bonus plan and long-term incentive plan. And if you go to the 2015 plan, it specifically talks about an incentive.
I think the concept generally that there may be annual incentive bonus plans was contemplated, but this particular plan was not contemplated. In particular, there was no plan in 2014. So I think it is a hypothetical future that if there are plans, he can participate in them. But again, there would need to be ascertainable standards of how those terms would be defined, and there's not. So, I mean, I think that a very important issue here is that Mr. Larwa's counsel argues that this is a particularizing document. If that were the case, Your Honors, then any document that was a subsequent document could be a particularizing document, because you could argue any document is adding details, and there would be no limit. It is a nonsensical argument to say that this is a particularizing document, because it goes well beyond that, and it doesn't meet either of the requirements in housing authority. There is no knowledge and assent of the terms, and there's no ascertainable standards. And the cases to which he cite are completely an opposite. I believe in LAM, which is the stock option plan, they discussed that there were clear ascertainable standards, and they discussed what those were. I believe it was section 10 of the stock plan agreement, which specifically said how those terms were going to be derived. If I could move on to the irreparable harm argument briefly, because
while I've got you, Ms. Cox, so the terms of the non-compete agreement were 3 years, so that which would be up in January of next year, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and the preliminary injunction entered by the district court does not end in January of next year.
There's not a date, correct, Your Honor? But I think it is intuitive and implied in that you know it would end upon trial or upon the entry of a permanent injunction, or naturally by its own terms with respect to expiration of the non-compete itself. I mean,
can I ask about that? So if the trial goes past the expiration date in January of 2021, you say it's still, the preliminary injunction still in effect?
No, Your Honor. I believe it is on its own terms. Agreeing to a tolling provision or tolling, you know, issue, which we've
are you seeking that?
We are.
And on what basis? I mean, I guess that's not really before us, but I'm just curious.
It's not. I mean, it just is as a matter of general principle. There was quite a bit of time that had elapsed where he was violating the agreement, and
okay, thank you.
But I just want to get to this irreparable harm issue, because this entire issue of the presumption is Mr. Lawless counsel's provision. There's no error in relying on a presumption under Connecticut law, but more importantly, the district court didn't rely solely on the presumption. We believe it made findings, and it made clear findings of actual harm. And I think that Mr. Lawless counsel has parsed through and taken out select language, but certainly when you read that on the whole, the district court stated Magellan has established sufficient irreparable harm to support the issuance of a preliminary injunction. And the word sufficient in that sentence is akin to showing that Magellan has met the necessary amount of proof. And I will just say—
What did the evidence show? What did the evidence show on the preliminary, on this?
With respect to, there was a plethora of evidence of irreparable harm, Your Honor. It showed that we had lost business. It showed that we had lost opportunities with respect to obtaining business. It showed that we had lost customer goodwill in terms of erosion and trust of our client relationships, and various other things. There was a plethora of evidence at the evidentiary hearing with respect to both of our legitimate business interests, the customer relationships, as well as the confidential information at issue here. And I see my time has expired. So unless the court has any further questions, We'll.
Any further questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you, Ms. Cox. Appreciate the presentation. Mr. Singer.
Thank you, Your Honors. This is a case where Mr. Larweth was fired, and he said unmistakably he was going to compete. And he did that through his lawyer in language, which you normally don't see. That makes that clear in June and then later. And the plaintiff, not the plaintiff, but Magellan did not act. And you do not have to have, if you believe you're uncertain about the facts, to wait on filing a motion for preliminary injunction. All the time, parties will face with much less than he was told here, filed a motion for preliminary injunction and seek expedited discovery.
Mr. Singer, just quickly, just so I understand the timeline, even if there was confusion about the terms and whether it was applicable or not, at the very least by October and November, when they actually filed the counterclaim, there was no, at least with regard to Magellan, they were not confused about their obligations, right?
Absolutely.
And then how long between November and when the preliminary injunction was actually filed?
It was a number of months later because you have
March
of 2019, I believe.
Right. That's about 5 months after
another 5 months.
And not
4 months from June to, I believe, October, and then 5 months from October to the filing of the motion for preliminary injunction. Now, the issue of prior breach. First of all, there is no magic words in Connecticut law where you have to use to incorporate the document. The document here makes reference to the fact that the employee will be eligible for a plan for bonuses. Secondly, there's not an issue here of assent. It is the employer who's coming up with this plan. The employer isn't asking for the employee's assent. The employer has his own plan. This would be different if the employee was coming in here and Mr. Larweth was saying, this wasn't a good enough bonus plan. I expected more. Then you would have an ascertainment issue. But not where the employer promulgates the plan and then the employee says, you're not paying me what you said you would pay me. And the district court doesn't allow that as a defense. Now, it doesn't matter if the CEO stands up and says, I viewed it as a standalone document. The issue of incorporation of a legal document is treated as a matter of law. And this court can review that.
Mr. Singer, I think that was a really good point you just made. Is there any case law that supports that point about the difference?
I'm not aware of a case law that says that expressly, but I think it follows from the idea that you incorporate documents so long as they particularize and describe what you had before, and the whole notion of ascertainability. Because what you want to avoid is a party being bound to something that that party did not agree to. But here you don't have that risk because the employer is simply being asked to enforce the very plan that it unilaterally created. So I don't think that any of the concerns expressed in any of the cases where you don't incorporate would be applicable here. This is a very clear ground for reversal of the preliminary injunction. So too with respect to the issue of irreparable harm. There is no defense that's been made an argument about the presumption properly being invoked here. No defense that somehow Connecticut presumption can apply in a federal court governed by Rule 65. No defense that even by the terms of Connecticut law that when you have this type of delay, for whatever reason, justifiable or not, the presumption does not apply. The only thing that's argued is, well, the court made these other findings, but there were not findings of irreparable injury separate from the presumption. There's no findings here that you couldn't calculate damages. And in fact, right now, this trial is one where Magellan is seeking millions of dollars of damages, showing that it can calculate that. But there's no findings that would show otherwise. So there are two independent bases on which this should be reversed on the record before this court. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Mr. Singer, you are the only male advocate we had today.
I noticed that.
Do you feel special?
It was a memorable day for diversity in the appellate court.
Well, thank you. I think you represented your gender well. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
And so did you, Ms. Cox. So we enjoyed the presentation. Appreciate the presentation. And that concludes our arguments for the day.